Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Relay Bitcoin session with a very special episode. As always, today we have a guest who comes from a traditional financial background, but has made his way into crypto and finally into Bitcoin. And he also wrote a book about the topic on a crypto portfolio. He will obviously be the one who can tell us more about this. It's a very, very interesting guy, Jonathan Hobbs. Maybe I let you introduce yourself, please.
Yeah, so thanks. Good to be on the show, Julian. So I started out in 2006, quite traditionally, at Morgan Stanley. I just come to London from South Africa, where I studied like finance and economics. And I thought, okay, well, let me get into the banking sector. And lucky enough, I was able to land a job at Morgan Stanley very early on. And I did. And from there, I kind of moved to HSBC. And did my rounds sort of doing a bunch of different things within the industry. From there, I ended up at an asset management firm in 2014 called M&G Investments. And I started to specialize in valuing complex assets. So, you know, assets which are just difficult to value and not priced by the market. So while I was there, I started becoming a lot more entrepreneurial and also interested in my own personal finances. So I guess I started to go to a lot of investment clubs after work, and I started becoming interested in helping people like learn how to invest. So I wrote like one book about investing in mutual funds. And then in 2017, I published it on Amazon, and to my surprise, it actually did okay. So I thought, okay, well, this is quite nice. I've just done something and people seem to like what I'm doing. So from that, it kind of led me to just resign from M&G and go full time and start my own kind of financial investment education blogging business, and also become an author and invest in my spare time. And that's how I started StopSaving.com, which is an investment education blog. And then this kind of goes into how I got into Bitcoin. So this was in June 2017. And I was sort of looking for content to write about. And about 2 months into that, one of my friends from high school, who I hadn't spoken to in about 15 years, he said to me, you know, I've read your blog and I'm kind of interested in learning, in investing in Bitcoin. And I sort of said to him, like the same thing most people, traditional guys would have said at that time. And I said, like, it's probably a massive Ponzi scheme and you're probably going to lose all your money. Now that was then, in 2017, but Linus was one of the smartest guys I knew at school. So I thought, okay, let me look into this. And then 2 weeks later, I'd looked into it and then I thought, okay, well, looking at the chart, it looks actually quite like it could go here, yeah, it could go up. So I started investing in Bitcoin, and this was in about August in 2017. And I used a strategy called value averaging. I'm happy to talk about that later, but it kind of got me in at good prices and got me out at good prices, which was nice because 2020, the 20K happened in December 2017. But what was more interesting about that is actually I was kind of documenting my progress on the strategy through some blog posts while I was doing it. And the traffic that it generated to my kind of new blog was just way superior to any traffic that had ever been generated by anything else I was producing. So that got me really excited because I thought, well, there's clearly a lot of interest in Bitcoin. And this is a topic that actually I'm really interested in. So I think I'm going to write another book. And I wrote a book called The Crypto Portfolio, which basically took me 7 months to do. And I spent a lot of time just kind of locked in a room, basically just learning about Bitcoin and going down the rabbit hole. So that I finally released that in April in 2018. And you know, despite it being in a bear market, it actually did quite well and sold a good amount of copies. I mean, I guess through that experience of kind of learning about Bitcoin, but then also having the 12 years or so of traditional finance behind me, I kind of had a new specialty. And then that led me to speaking to some guys at a startup hedge fund at the time called Ecstatus Capital, which yeah, I mean, they're a quant digital asset hedge fund. So I joined them as a consultant in the beginning and built out their investment strategies in 2018. And then I ended up as chief investment officer of the firm and stayed on as a partner and director until recently, where I've actually just kind of stepped back from that role. And now I'm focusing more on content again and kind of doing my own thing, as it were.
Awesome. So can you talk a little bit more about how did you get into Bitcoin, and how did it feel coming from like from all this indoctrination from the traditional financial system and education system around that topic to this whole new, you know, decentralized finance and especially Bitcoin? You know, Bitcoin has this revolutionary financial system and sound money and digital gold and all that concept. So how did you get into that, and what role does Bitcoin play in your life now? Like, how did Bitcoin change your life? I mean, you can be very independent now and self-employed, and as you say, like, do your own thing. Is that also because of you getting into Bitcoin very early? Like, yeah. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Well, I think, I mean, you know, I got into Bitcoin at that time when my friend from school told me about it. That was when I started learning about it. And the more I learned about it, the more interested I got about it. And it eventually just became almost an obsession for a while. And that's why I ended up writing that book. But I think I guess probably since about 2014, when I started going to those investment clubs, you know, I did become very concerned about the general global financial system. Even back then, they were printing their way out of 2008 and you know, I was kind of, you know, concerned about the global economy. You know, a lot of these
even
guys
before you knew Bitcoin, right? Like on the concept
I think it was more just a case of you look at the markets and you think like they keep going up, and we've been in the longest equity bull market in as long as anyone can remember. But even in 2014, you know, there were a lot of guys calling the top. Which is funny because it's just kept going up. But that was kind of, I think that was always there. I've also been, I guess, in that sort of time, I've also been kind of entrepreneurial and open to new things. I've always been open to exploring new ideas and new concepts. So those things kind of gelled together quite well. And when I learned about Bitcoin and started getting involved, it was easy from there. It kind of just all fell into place. In terms of how Bitcoin, the second part kind of fits into my own life, I think probably the best thing to do is like define what I think Bitcoin is, and then we can kind of go from there. So sure. the whole thing about Bitcoin being something that you're going to go to Starbucks and use Bitcoin to buy a cup of coffee, I don't see it that way. I think that's a long way off. And you know, for small transactions right now, Bitcoin is not great. It can only do 2,000 transactions in a 10-minute block. But something like Visa, at least what they say on their website, can do 65,000 transactions in 1 second. So for small transactions, it's not great. But that doesn't mean I'm not bullish on it. So there are four like other things I would say which Bitcoin is. You know, that are probably more important than that. The first thing is that for as a payment system for large international transactions. So, you know, I could send $10 to South Africa, or I could send $10,000 to South Africa. The blockchain doesn't care whether it's in South Africa, it doesn't care about the amount. It's going to process it in the same amount of time without going through the international banking system, which means it's going to be less delays, and it's going to be cheaper in larger amounts. So as a payment system for large sending large volumes is good, and it beats anything else you'll find. The second thing I would say is that Bitcoin, the digital gold narrative, I mean, this to me, it does make a lot of sense. I think Bitcoin is a lot like digital gold. It's very similar to gold in a lot of ways. You can mine it, it's scarce, it's got people who follow it and believe in it, and to me that makes sense. So there's the digital gold narrative and a hedge against potential inflation we might see coming around the corner with all the money printing that's going on. The third thing Bitcoin is actually like it's a venture investment, right? It's a long-term, arguably speculative venture investment on the long-term growth of the blockchain space. So it's like if you just invested in the internet from the beginning, and there was a company called the internet, and you invested in that, like that's kind of how I see Bitcoin. It's the whole, if the blockchain space goes up, Bitcoin's going to go up with it. So it's like a venture investment into that. And then the final thing is it's a commodity, a digital commodity, which you can trade long and short. And that's something I do because it's volatile. And actually, if you're a trader, volatility is a good thing. So there's those things, basically. That's the way I see it. And then obviously, it's something I write content about. So yeah, that's
I like that. I like the like structured way you pointed out these couple of areas, because Bitcoin is not just one thing, right? It can be different things to different people. I mean, Bitcoin means something else for me as a Swiss guy, you know, privileged Swiss guy. It means a whole lot of a whole different thing for a Venezuelan kid in the same age that has like poor, very, very poor circumstances to live in and has a very poor financial and political system. And it's a very different thing for them. It might be, you know, the digital gold and the payment system that you said, that the international payment system, how they can pay people living across other borders, for example. For me, it might be more like a speculative thing, or like, you know, so they are different things. They are, it's commodities. It's, as you say, it's an investment in a different future. And I also think it's an emerging store of value. So even though it might not be a very broadly accepted store of value now, it's an emergent store of value. So it's like you can make an investment. It's like you can make an investment in gold when it was not used as a store of value yet. You know, so that's something that's very interesting. I like how you pointed this out and you laid out these four or five different areas. That's very cool. And so you also, in your book, you talk a lot about what effects Bitcoin has on traditional portfolios. So like many people today who are investing a little bit, are investing in different asset classes, like, for example, stocks, bonds, maybe commodities, maybe real estate, whatever. So they have a traditional portfolio. And then what happens if you mix Bitcoin in this traditional portfolio? What effects does this have? You talk a lot about this in your blogs as well. Can you explain a little bit to like people who are not familiar with, you know, investing in Bitcoin and stuff, what happens if you do that?
Yeah, so I think I might have to steal an answer here from someone I heard at a Bloomberg conference, a guy named Yves Chirifati. It's a French name, so I'm probably pronouncing it wrong. He is a hedge fund manager of a $12 billion hedge fund, traditional asset hedge fund. So he really like knows what he's talking about. And he said that Bitcoin is basically a lot like chlorine. You can use a small amount of it and it'll keep your swimming pool clean. But if you drink it, you'll die, you know? So I think that analogy really worked for me. I thought, well, that's really good. And it kind of makes a lot of sense. And if you think about it, that's exactly how Bitcoin behaves in a portfolio of other assets altogether. So I guess we can use an example. Yeah, let's just say, and I was doing some research for a blog post, but I was looking at some numbers. If you bought Bitcoin, and let's just say you put all of your money in Bitcoin, like every last cent in 2012, and you didn't hold any other investment in January 2012 all the way until the middle or until present day, let's say, you would have made about a 130% return on your investment on average, compounded a year, which is actually an amazing return. It's higher than anything anyone can imagine. It's actually about 1,000x if you compound it, which just shows the power of compounding. But at the same time, I don't think any investor who'd actually did that, who put all their money in at that time, would have managed to hold Bitcoin all the way until present day. And the reason being, in that time, Bitcoin's actually had four 80% plus corrections. It's had several other corrections that have been 30, 40, 50%. So that's going to scare most investors off, and they're probably going to end up selling near the bottom and then buying back in later. So it's difficult to do that. You take another investor who's just invested in the S&P 500, which is the US stock market, for example, and they started at the same time, they would have made 11% return on average compounded a year, which is it's actually a good return. It's nothing to scoff at. But they would have only had a 25% drawdown, like a maximum loss from the peak to the bottom. So that's okay. But now what happens if you took 2% of that S&P portfolio and you put it into Bitcoin, and then you rebalance that exposure every quarter so that it was never more than two, like once, if it goes over 2%, you rebalance it back to 2%. That's the key here. That portfolio would have made about 15.5% on average every single year, which is a fantastic return for any like fund manager. And the drawdown would have actually been a little bit lower. It would be about 23% versus the 25% of the pure S&P. So that just kind of shows you the effect of increasing returns. You know, you can play devil's advocate here and say, okay, well, what if you had started this portfolio in December 2017 when Bitcoin was near 20K and done the same thing? Like, logically, you'd probably think that you would make less than the pure S&P portfolio. But actually, because you rebalance and always get back to 2%, even when Bitcoin goes down, buy more to top it back up, that portfolio would have actually slightly beaten the S&P and had a slightly about the same drawdown. So about 5% overall on average, but that's just because the equity markets have had a bad couple of years. So that's kind of really shows you how, I think, provided you know, none of this is investment advice, obviously, I'm not giving investment advice, but personally, my view is that as long as you are rebalancing, and you don't have too much, it's very, very good. Bitcoin can be very good as a diversifier, and it can be like chlorine, as the guy would say.
Yeah, because if you always hold on to the same percentage of Bitcoin, then as you say, if the price goes up, then you're going to sell a little bit. And if the price goes down, you're going to buy a little bit. That's something that, you know, with all these other strategies, like for example, dollar cost averaging, like having a weekly savings plan, for example, it's the same effect. It's something that Relay, for example, provides. You can put like $100 a week in the fixed amount and then just let it roll. And then it's exactly the same effect. If the price is high, you buy less, and if the price is low, you buy more, and that's what gives you the good effects on the long run. And it the same thing, I never thought about it, but the same thing you explained, when you have a portfolio and a small part of it is Bitcoin, if you keep that stable, then you have the same effect, which obviously in the long run, it doesn't matter how the trend is going or how the big ups and downs are going, you're always on the better side, which is very interesting.
So, yeah, but it's basically forcing you to buy low and sell high over time, every quarter. Exactly. So even with the rebalancing there, like that investor would have had to buy Bitcoin pretty much at the bottom one quarter when it was near 3K. Not every quarter, but specifically on that quarter. So
that's fascinating. Yeah. It's a winning strategy. And so how do you go about finding the right valuation for Bitcoin? Like let's say in 1, 5, or 10 years from now, how do you go about finding out how much value and what the price will be? Because you say you come from this, you know, traditionally you come from this profession, so you can actually, you know how to value assets, you know, so this is a skill you have. So how do you go about valuating Bitcoin?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's going to probably sound, I don't spend a lot of time trying to predict what the value of something's going to be in the future. And purely because there's so many variations to valuing anything, and there's so many different models that I'll probably be wrong. And no one can really predict the future, right? But saying that, I'm still bullish on Bitcoin. And I do think its price will go up over time. And the simplest way for me to explain that is dollars. So fiat currencies, pounds, euros, yens, take your pick. These are all getting printed at a faster and faster rate, but Bitcoin is getting mined at a slower and slower rate. So you have a situation where you're going to have more and more fiat currency chasing the same amount of Bitcoins. And interestingly enough, 90% of all Bitcoins have like already been mined. but 90% of dollars have definitely not already been printed. So if you just take those two things, you think, well, assuming, like, if Bitcoin is to stay around for the foreseeable future, which to me it looks like it is, then the value, at least in dollar terms, should go up purely based on the fact that we should get inflation at some point in the future. The other way to probably to value it is if I had to take a pick and take a guess at what I think it would be worth sometime in the future, and there's no timeline on this, by the way, but if you had to think of Bitcoin as like digital gold, which is a pretty good narrative in my opinion, in the world, and you put it in one place, you could fill up like four Olympic-sized swimming pools, and the value of all of that gold in those four swimming pools would be worth $14 trillion today, at $2,000 an ounce to gold. All the Bitcoin in the world, if you had to take that all now, that is worth $200 billion roughly, if you look at coin market cap, which is actually kind of the same as what Jeff Bezos's net wealth is, right? So it's, or net worth. So it's a lot smaller. For that Bitcoin to get to the same valuation as gold, it could go up 70 times. So if you take a Bitcoin price of, like, let's just call it 10K for simplicity, you're looking at a value there with all other things being equal of like $700,000. Now, will it get to $700,000? Like, I have no idea. No one can predict what's going to happen. But if it did get there or anywhere near there, I think there's two ways it could do that. The first is you get like massive inflation, in which case $700,000 is not worth that much money. So Bitcoin's relatively has held its value and dollars have lost their value. The second would be institutions start to allocate that 1% of capital that everyone wants. And if that happened, I mean, that's a lot of money, and that would really boost the valuation. So we'll just have to see how it pans out.
Yeah, speaking about institutions, like just recently we heard about quite some institutions, institutional investors, but also like operational institutions, like just companies that have a normal business, but have a big cash balance because they're successful, making a lot of profit, allocating 1%, 2%, 5%, whatever percent, or a certain percentage into Bitcoin. So, but these obviously, these institutions are like the early adopters. They're like the first ones to do that. But imagine, like, because a lot of rational, you know, financial advisors start to advise that you have some allocation into Bitcoin. And so imagine if they all started just putting 1% into it. And as you said, 90% of the Bitcoin already there, there will only be 21 million. So you just need to imagine the pressure, the demand pressure that goes onto Bitcoin, and as we all know, if the supply is, you know, fixed as it is in Bitcoin, and if there's increasing demand, then obviously the price will also increase. So this is a very interesting perspective. Talking about institutions, like institutional investors, for example, like family offices, asset managers, you have some experience there because of your previous work, and also because of your advisory role from time to time. You are speaking to institutional investors. You know what they're, you know, all about, how they think about maybe stuff like Bitcoin as well. How do you think, how far away are you know, the majority of institutional investors from getting into a Bitcoin?
I think institutions, they've obviously got a lot of money, but they're very slow to move on things. They're more in the business of, I guess, staying rich rather than getting rich. So everything an institution does, it's going to take a lot of time for them to really go over the details. So they're not in a rush. But saying that, though, you know, just from the kind of general sense I've got, most of it, I think, is where we are now. And you're kind of talking about the early adopters of institutional early adopters, which is obviously after the retail early adopters, which has long since happened. it's probably your traditional hedge funds. So Renaissance Capital got in and starting to invest in Bitcoin. So there's traditional hedge funds that are looking into this because they've kind of got a broader mandate than some of the more retail asset managers. But then you've also got digital asset crypto Bitcoin hedge funds. So these guys, there's a lot of them that have started, and you know, I was at Ecstatus Capital, so I know there are quite a few hedge funds that started recently in London who are, for example, investing a lot in Bitcoin. So there's definitely that side of things. There's that, and then I think I'm just trying to think what else. Could you just repeat the rest of the question?
Yeah, so just how are institutionals thinking about it? How far away do you think they are from investing in Bitcoin? Do you think like they are all thinking about it, or is there still a big portion of, you know, institutionals that just don't even think about it, not interesting for them, you know, kind of?
Well, I think it's down to what their clients think. So if Bitcoin starts to go on a run, they're going to get more and more pressure from their clients to get involved. You know, I think that most skilled traditional investors, so your fund managers, these guys, they're probably like, they're not scared of the volatility of Bitcoin. Yeah, they actually probably, that's part of the charm for them. They probably want to get in because of the volatility. So for them, it's not about whether or not they think that adding a small amount of Bitcoin is going to have a good effect on the overall portfolio, because these are just numbers. They understand numbers and you can interpret them. So that's not the issue. I think what it is it's kind of like if a fund manager today, if I was a fund manager and I was managing a pension fund and I went into the pension, I'd have to go to the risk committee of the pension fund and say, hey, I want to add some Bitcoin to it. I'll start a Bitcoin fund. For our retail clients, for example, the risk committee is going to say, okay, well, like, what are you going to do to allow us to do that? And there's basically, like, I'd say three things. The first thing is they need custody and institutional grade solid custody so that they know that the Bitcoin is safe, and it's got to be regulated custody too. That's already happening quite rapidly in the space. The second thing is they're going to have processes, procedures, controls, everything to manage every kind of possible regulatory manual error risk possible that any asset manager has for anything else. And those take a lot of time, you know. The third thing is and this is probably the most important thing, is that risk committee's got to look at Bitcoin and go, okay, well, this is pretty much the same as investing in stocks or equities or gold. There's no difference. And right now, because there is a difference, it's going to be harder to convince this risk committee to say yes. So that's the obstacle. It's not the investors who understand. You know, I don't think it's the investors as much as it is the compliance and the risk. So the question is then, how similar is it for these guys to invest in Bitcoin as it is to invest in anything else? And there's a few ways where it's actually very different, but actually there's a lot of ways where it is similar. So you've got KYC. So like CipherTrace, for example, when you onboard clients, we onboarded clients in Bitcoin at our fund, and we would use CipherTrace to scan the blockchain to see if that was good money, and that's fine. So institutional grade custody solutions you can have, that's the same thing. There's many of those right now. Coin Finance, BitGo, Gemini, you know, Coinbase custody, Fidelity even, there's a long list. So you've also got OTC. So a lot of these institutions are buying it over the counter. They're not buying it on the exchange. And that's why you don't see the price effect, right? So there's a lot of accumulation going on, which we don't even see. So OTC is very important for these guys because they're moving big amounts of money. So they're not going to want to buy Bitcoin on an exchange because the amount of money they're putting in, they're going to move the price. So I think it's those things mainly. That's probably where.
And so we if we want to onboard these big guys, these traditional, you know, institutionals, then we need to kind of build something that they are comfortable with. So all the elements that they are used to when making traditional investments. We kind of need to build it if we want to do that. I don't say this is a good thing, but like if we want them in, then we would need to build all these things around it, all the whole infrastructure that they're used to, because otherwise it doesn't really fit in their square, right? What about retail investors though, like normal people like you and me, but like who are more traditional investors or not even, you know, invested a lot of their money yet and are just coming into investing? They usually don't really start with Bitcoin because they usually don't really understand it yet or think it's a high risk. So they're a bit afraid or they're cautious usually. So what do you think it needs for this majority of like traditional, you know, small investors to allocate some part of their, you know, savings or investing capital to Bitcoin? What needs to change to go from the early adopters that are investing in Bitcoin now, which is probably between 5% and 10% of the population, to like a majority of the population considering an investment in Bitcoin?
Yeah, I think it's probably like, is it easy enough for like your grandmother to invest in Bitcoin? And I think that's kind of where we need to be. I started investing in Bitcoin in 2017, which is actually quite late. And there were people investing it long before me. But even then it was a mission. I remember having to kind of like use Kraken. I'd do a separate transfer from my UK bank account to Kraken because they didn't have a UK bank account. I then had to convert those euros into other coins and send it to Binance if I wanted to get anything else. And it was a lot of work. Whereas with stocks and funds, which I'd always invested in myself, I could just go on Hargreaves Lansdown, which is a platform I use, and a broker platform, and just, you know, click buy and send the money. And it was a lot easier. So that's kind of the whole thing. But actually, if you look at where we are today, it's kind of like people have been building in the bear market, and the exchanges that are starting to come through, you know, Coinbase, for example, so easy to use. Obviously, it's not perfect, but there's exchanges like FTX, which now have UK accounts, and things are just getting a lot more familiar to people, that even retail investors. So it's just like with these institutional investors, it's got to be similar. Investing in Bitcoin's got to be similar for them. It's the same with some of the retail investors. You know, the easier it is for them and the more familiar it is to anything else, I guess the more that they will invest. And but we're seeing that now. It's a lot easier now to get to buy Bitcoin and invest in Bitcoin than it was in 2017. I see it getting more widely adopted.
Absolutely. In that way. Absolutely. I really also think that's, you know, that there are some burdens still, but people are working on it. We are working on it, for example, to make this burden really small, like even having your grandma being able to use it. So everybody, the goal is that everybody who can, you know, use WhatsApp or use any other easy app can also use our app or any other app to buy Bitcoin. And I think this will, and once people start realizing that it's actually so easy, that it's actually even easier to buy Bitcoin than to buy stocks, then I think a lot of them will consider at least a small investment. And once they are invested, they will also get into the rabbit hole, you know, and so that's how it goes. Usually once you have a stake, then you also spend more time thinking about it and researching about it. And, you know, you get into this rabbit hole and you think it's cool, and then you invest more. And so I also think that's an important transition that we are part of now, which is what makes it so interesting to be part of this revolution, to be part of this time right now. And so I would like to talk about these different strategies that you describe in your book, The Crypto Portfolio, which I actually really highly recommend everybody to have a look into. It's a small book. It's very easy to understand. It's well written, very concise. It's a short read, and it's also a cheap read, so it's really perfect. So head on to Amazon or wherever you can buy this and buy it. Also, it's also interesting for, you know, Bitcoin maximalists or people who are not, you know, interested in all the other cryptos. It's not really about crypto, and it's also about how to apply traditional strategies, easy strategies for retail investors to this new asset class and to Bitcoin. So please, because I think that's also a very important thing for newcomers to do, you know, to get educated and then to start with small amounts and with easy strategies. That's very important for newcomers. And so please talk about the different, the main different easy strategies, how people can get onboarded to Bitcoin.
The book kind of goes into a lot of detail on a few different things. I mean, it's kind of split into three parts. Part two is the simple stuff, which is dollar cost averaging and value averaging, which I'll go into now. And then the third section is on technical analysis, which is a bit more advanced. But I think the main principles of the simpler strategies, you know, and again, this is not investment advice. It's just something that I think works personally. Is the first thing is like, don't invest all your money in one go. So obviously, like, don't put all your money in at the top, because if you'd invested all in one go, and you'd bought Bitcoin at 20K, you'd be down right now, you know, if you hadn't already sold it. So there's that. The second thing is, and it's quite simple, is don't put all your money in Bitcoin. Personally, spread your risk and invest in different assets and rebalance. So that's quite self-explanatory, the chlorine metaphor, which we went over earlier. But the second part about the dollar cost averaging, so dollar cost averaging is just really simple. It's basically just saying that you invest the same amount every single month, regardless of the price. So that same investor, if that investor dollar cost averaged from December 2017, and it's first time he bought Bitcoin, it was 20K, but he kept buying Bitcoin every single month, all the way until present day, that investor actually would be in profit right now, because he would have accumulated enough Bitcoin, and the average price at which he accumulated Bitcoin would actually be lower. I think it'd be about $7,000 if you look at the maths. And the price of Bitcoin now today is about 11,200. It's moving around now, and we'll see what it does. But so that investor would be in profit, whereas the investor that got in early would obviously be down nearly 50%. So that's one way to accumulate Bitcoin. And I think anyone who has a view that Bitcoin is going to go up long term, they should look to accumulate it. And if they're going to do that, dollar cost averaging is a good way to accumulate. The second kind of way that I see, or the second strategy, which I go into quite a lot of detail on in the book, is the value averaging strategy, which is what I did myself in December 2017, with a small amount of capital. But value averaging is like dollar cost averaging in a way, except instead of investing the same amount of dollars every single month, like you would with dollar cost averaging, you invest a different amount of dollars every month, depending on the price of Bitcoin every month. So on months where the price of Bitcoin is low, you actually invest a lot more. On months when the price of Bitcoin is high, you would invest less. And then on months where Bitcoin is really high, like December 2017, January 2018, or whatever, you would actually have to take some profits and kind of get out of a lot of your position. So that can kind of work quite well in a ranging market, because you're constantly accumulating and re-getting in. And I guess, you know, the way it works, I mean, maybe if I could just use a quick example. Let's say you've got $100. Let's say you want to invest $100 in Bitcoin every single month for 10 months. You don't want to put 100 exactly in every month, but you want, at the end of those 10 months, you want $1,000 worth of Bitcoin. The value of your Bitcoin must be $1,000. So in the first month, you invest $100, and you know, you get some Bitcoin. Month two comes around, Bitcoin is halved in price, let's say. Because Bitcoin's halved in price. Your $100 that you had in Bitcoin is now actually $50 because you've lost half your money. But you want to get back to $200 now. So instead of putting $100 like you would dollar cost averaging, you actually have to put $150. You see, so you're investing more when it's less. And the same thing happens in reverse. So that strategy, like I go into a lot of detail on, it sounds like the perfect strategy because you're obviously buying more and taking profits. But, you know, there are certain times where it's not going to work as well. So for example, if Bitcoin keeps going up and up and up and up and up, and it just doesn't stop, every single month it keeps going up, what will happen with value averaging is because it's always going up, you're not actually going to be accumulating a lot. You might just buy a little bit, and then every month you're buying like less and less, and you're not going to make any money, right? Whereas with dollar cost averaging, you would actually make more than value averaging because you'd be accumulating still set amounts every month. But markets don't go up in a straight line. You know, it's going to range. And then if it went down, if Bitcoin just kept going down and down and down until like, you know, $1,000, let's say, I mean, value averaging would bleed you dry because you'd basically be doubling down every single month, buying more and more and more. So that's going to hurt you. But that strategy, if you'd done that from, I guess, 2017 at the peak, it would have worked out very well. But you would have to have stuck to the strategy until kind of when Bitcoin started turning around, and then it would have taken off. But hindsight is always 20/20, as they say.
So if I understand correctly, with value averaging, the deal is that you want to have $100 in Bitcoin the first month, $200 the second, $300 the third, and whatever happens to the price, then you obviously have to correct. So you buy $100, and then if there's a halving in the price, then you have to put $150 so that you end up with $200 again. If it then doubles from these 200 to 400, but you want to be at 300 the third month, then you have to sell $100, right? Is that correct?
Yeah, you got it. Exactly.
Okay, cool. Very interesting. Yeah. So, and you also compare the performances, right, of these two strategies in a book. Can you talk about this a little bit more? It obviously depends probably on how the price goes, but how can we compare these two?
Yes, I think before I get to that, I mean, just one thing I've learned with backtesting, when you backtest any strategy, it can look amazing on paper, but they don't always pan out the way, the same in reality. It's just how things are. So I try to be as kind of thorough as I could. And I tested it on Ripple, Litecoin, Ethereum, and other altcoins too, just to make sure that the strategy kind of did what it said on the tin. And off the top of my head, I mean, I can't remember the numbers exactly, but if you look at it just purely as percentage return on invested, so what you actually invested versus the money you would have gotten back, that value averaging strategy would have beaten dollar cost averaging overall on most years. I think the only time it didn't was in those scenarios that I was referring to earlier, where you would have accumulated more Bitcoin with something like dollar cost averaging because of the price wasn't ranging as much and going as down. And then dollar cost averaging would have actually worked in your favor because, I mean, for example, I mean, we'll take something. I think it was, I tested it on Ripple, and I mean, Ripple went nuts in 2017. It went from like 20 cents to like a dollar in November, and then to $3, and then it went all the way back down. But that strategy with dollar cost averaging would have done better in that particular year because in November you wouldn't have sold any Ripple. You would have still held your Ripple, which was a dumb thing to do anyway. If you look at the way it was going up parabolically, but with value averaging, you'd be forced to sell some, and then you would have been forced to sell some in December too. So that's just kind of the way it works. So the way I see value averaging, it's kind of adding an element of profiting from the volatility, not just from the trend. And I think with Bitcoin, it is quite volatile, obviously. So yeah, it's something that can work. Again, not something I recommend blindly to use as your overall strategy, but as an accumulation method as part of a portfolio, then it's worked out good for me at least. And you know.
Yeah, so. And both of these strategies work better than trying to time the market if you're not an expert, you know.
Exactly. I mean, time in the market is better than timing the market, as they say. So
that's it.
Yeah,
that's
you can never call the top or bottom ever. Because even at 20K, when Bitcoin was 20K, it could have made sense to keep investing because we didn't know that that would turn around. You know, a lot of people in hindsight can look at the chart and say it looked like it was going to pop. But you don't really know. It could have, more money could have still come in. So, and that was a trend, and the trend is your friend until kind of the end. So, it's definitely not easy to time the market. Even when Bitcoin was at 3K, it still looked very bearish because it was in this massive descending triangle. And it looked like it could have gone down more. So even then, it seemed risky to buy it, but actually it turned around. So it's very difficult to agree.
Nobody can time the market, but everybody can just set up a simple dollar cost averaging strategy, automate it, and then let it roll. And then you usually do better than everybody else who tries to time the market, at least on the long run. And then if you're even more advanced, I would say probably, at least in my eyes, then you could even go after a value averaging strategy, where then again manual work and some calculations are involved, but potentially, or even if the market goes into like a horizontal and a little bit up and down direction, then it could even be more the returns could even be more, it could even be more profitable. Exactly. Oh, very interesting. Very good insights. Thank you very much. And we're already at our last question, which I think is mostly the most interesting one for me, at least. How much of your total funds do you hold in Bitcoin?
Yeah. Okay. So I'm happy to say that. I think if you look at liquid investments, so money that is liquid and available at any given time, I probably hold 10% of that in Bitcoin. That's not just holding Bitcoin. So 3% of that is holding long term, and I just kind of leave it, and I'm not really concerned with what happens to it. 7% is trading. So I trade, I use FTX and I trade futures. I trade Bitcoin long and short because I like the volatility, and it's easier for me to manage risk doing that. So, and that's more nimble. I can kind of trade other wherever I see a trading opportunity. Then the other 90%, I've kind of split into four different buckets. Bucket one is kind of my, aside from Bitcoin, it's my long-term inflation proof, I call it. So that's gold, silver, and gold mining stocks, because I think gold it's a fantastic investment. It's held its value. An ounce of gold used to buy a senator, a Roman toga. Today it buys a politician, a seat in London. So like the value of gold has not changed since for thousands of years, right? So gold is a good thing. The other part of that is bonds. So bond fund, and bonds are kind of do the opposite thing. Bonds protect you from deflation. So it's a fixed income investment. Basically, if I'm earning fixed income from a bond and we get deflation, let's say I'm earning £10 in interest, that interest is actually going to be worth more in relative terms because the value of it has gone up in real terms because there's been deflation. And you might say, well, with all this money printing, why are we looking at deflation? And the way I see it is that the governments of the world have put everyone in lockdown. I mean, people aren't spending money, restaurants are closed, people aren't traveling, all of these things are happening. And that is very deflationary because if people aren't spending money, there's deflation. So bonds I still hold, even though they are expensive, I do allocate to bonds. Then I've got another section, which is the third bucket, which is stocks. And that's basically mutual funds, which hold stocks. And I'm looking at quality stocks with good cash flows, kind of defensive, that can survive I guess, turbulent times, which I think we're heading into. And international stocks also from all different countries. And then smaller UK company stocks and emerging market Asia's stocks. And then the last bucket is just cash, you know, pounds and dollars, and because it's just good to have some set aside. And also it allows you the opportunity if things do take a dive, if things, you know, if the market turns around, because right now we don't know, really know what's going to happen. Very, very uncertain market at the moment. And it's not just stocks, it's everything really. It's a liquidity issue. Then you've got cash on the sidelines to pick up some deals. So that's kind of my take at the moment and how I'm approaching things.
Cool. Hey, it's so good to hear that somebody who spends so much time and energy into, you know, thinking about how to allocate his portfolio and stuff, to hear that such a guy like you who does this has actually a 10% allocation in Bitcoin. So you really believe it's a good addition after all these studies that you did. It's a good addition for every portfolio. So that's very interesting. Thank you very, very much, John, to have taken the time. It was very, very interesting. I always, you know, read about you and your book. I read your book and I read your blog, and to have you here now talking about my favorite topic, which is Bitcoin investing, was really really good. Thank you very much. It was fascinating. Thanks for your insights. Thanks for your time, and have a great rest of the day. Talk to you soon.
Thanks, Julian. Thanks for having me, and yeah, really good to talk to you.
Sure, and keep stacking. Bye bye. Cheers,
mate. Thanks, bye.